This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. General elections held in the UK last week delivered a stunning defeat for incumbent Prime Minister Theresa May and her party, with the loss of a significant number of seats in Parliament. May called a snap election on June 8th, hoping to capitalize on the Conservative Party's majority in order to have a greater mandate to carry out Britain's exit from the European Union. But the election has left the Tories with a far weaker political standing, thanks in large part to gains by the Labour Party. Often referred to as the Bernie Sanders of the UK, Progressive Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn pushed his party to the left and helped deliver the largest gains in Parliament in years. Now, Prime Minister May has been forced to form a coalition with the Democratic Unionist Party from Northern Ireland in order to form a government. But her position and that of her parties remains extremely weak. What lessons can the left in other democratic countries take from the UK elections? Joining me at the People's Summit in Chicago was Laura Flanders, a broadcast journalist, progressive activist, and best-selling author of Bush Women, Tales of a Cynical Species, and her earlier book, Blue Grit, True Democrats Take Back Politics from the Politicians. She's also a contributing writer to The Nation and Yes Magazine, and you can watch the Laura Flanders show on Free Speech TV. I'm here with Laura Flanders at the People's Summit in Chicago, a three-day event organized by a number of groups like the National Nurses United, etc. And welcome, Laura.
Oh, it's so fun to be with you, Sonali, and everybody here at Free Speech TV. What a pleasure to be together at last, I should say.
So it's such an interesting timing for this gathering because, of course, right before this gathering, as my producer and I were getting on a plane, not only did we have the Comey hearings unfolding here in the U.S., but in the U.K. we had these major elections that that were poised to change the game, and indeed it looks like they have changed the game. I want to talk to you about the U.K. elections. So many people were hoping, a lot of the hopeful ones were hoping we would be saying Prime Minister Jeremy Corbyn today. It didn't happen. That might have been expecting too much. But do you still see what happened as a big victory for the left?
Oh, my goodness, an enormous victory. And I think we have to be very careful when we raise the bar so high. People need to remember that Jeremy Corbyn never even wanted to have the leadership of the Labour Party. But when he came in, the guns were out by the Labour Party establishment, and they've been out against him for years. So the fact that this man was able to increase the Labour Party's share of the vote by the biggest margin it's increased since the 1940s is extraordinary. And he did it in 6 weeks. These are short campaigns. These are campaigns where the opposition to him from within his own party and then extraordinarily piled on by the Conservatives cast him as, I mean, Theresa May, the Prime Minister, the Conservative Prime Minister, spent basically 2 years casting him as a terrorist sympathizer. This in a period where the British have been, you know, experiencing multiple terror attacks. She is now unable to make a government without the assistance of a party from Northern Ireland that has a history of relationships with loyalist paramilitary organizations. So if you want to talk about extremist paramilitary groups in Northern Ireland propping up your election, your government, which is what Theresa May said of Jeremy Corbyn prime ministership would look like, now we have that, but it's on the other side. And the more important thing I think we have is an incredible shot in the arm for organizers in the UK behind a very simple message that resonated: for the many, not the few. People thought it was too simple. The media beat up on it, but it resonated. And a manifesto, which is to say a plan of action that is made public to the voters.
Kind of like a party platform.
Except that it's made public to the voters, and it is only as big as it takes to read on a doorstep, including things like the renationalization of the railways, was a hit. So, I mean, Jeremy Corbyn came much closer than anyone, especially he, I think, but ever dreamt possible to becoming prime minister last night. That wasn't expected. What was expected by Theresa May was that she was going to call a snap election, the one that she said she'd never call, that would issue her into greater security and a much enlarged majority. She lost her majority, and he picked up 31 seats. So my poem for the day has been 31, it can be done. Let's do it here.
So she took a huge gamble upon the advice of the person who's managing Brexit to have snap elections to increase the Conservative Party's foothold in Parliament. And they ended up losing. And the only way to govern now is to get into this coalition with the Democratic Unionist Party. Where does that leave Brexit? And where does that also leave Theresa May's leadership within her party?
Well, it's very confusing. I mean, the fact that the Democratic Unionist Party is her, you know, what stands between her and complete collapse is very complicated, because the DUP want to maintain no border between the north of Ireland and the south for trading purposes, that no border that existed as long as both Ireland and the north of Ireland as part of the United Kingdom were both part of Europe. But I just misspoke. They opposed maintaining that border. They were for Brexit, that borderless zone. They were for Brexit, but for many of their own sort of local reasons. They wanted to retain that border that had disappeared with the European Union. I had covered Northern Ireland in the 80s, and when I went back there last year, it was the most remarkable aspect of what had happened there was how invisible the border was. Well, the DUP want Brexit, supported Brexit, but for very kind of local reasons having to do with their status in the north, not for the reasons that are shared by most of the people in the Brexit-supporting constituencies of the UK. The other thing that's really important is that by binding her government to the DUP with respect to Europe, it's very obvious the politics of that decision. I mean, this is a religiously sectarian party that is anti-choice, that is extreme conservative on most of the issues, and is still at war in its own sort of culture with the Catholic majority and papists. So
by doing a deal with this party, she risks shrinking the Conservative Party's base even more?
I think so. I mean, I think there are many cities inside of the UK where there's still a lot of anxiety around that kind of conservatism. It's not actually Tory party conservatism, really. It's only in the north of Ireland you get that kind of weird religious fight, and it's not just a religious fight, but that has been the frame of it. But across Europe, too, it is not good for her relations with the continent. And I have to say, you know, it's we may be over focusing on it because it is so extraordinary. But I think it will not resonate well. And I think what happens to Brexit now, well, it's like 12 days from now. They have to start negotiations. Nobody really knows where it's going to go. And the candidate, the prime minister who said what is needed is security and stability and reliability, has delivered the opposite of all of those.
So where does this election leave the Labour Party? Because as you mentioned, Jeremy Corbyn faced so much opposition from his own party. We can see parallels in the Democratic Party and their relationship with Bernie Sanders last year. But he has basically proved to the Labour Party that moving left can win you power, political power. So the question now is, will they rally behind his leadership, and will they take his message to heart and adopt it fully?
Well, I think his leadership is secure, which is the first time we've been able to say that since he won his leadership by a landslide the first time around. This is an extraordinary turnaround for him, and you've seen all day people kind of eating their words and eating their hats and eating whatever else they put out in bids.
Unelectable, right, was the word?
Exactly. So I think we want to look at history here. It's move to the left is true, but what was really significant about, what is really significant about the campaign of Jeremy Corbyn and the Jeremy Corbyn agenda and manifesto as presented this year, and it was the party manifesto decided by the party, was how much it returned back to a type of Labour Party tradition that existed in the earlier part of the 20th century, in the early 1900s, where you had really a commitment to sharing the wealth of the state, the welfare state, public goods, publicly owned utilities. What I think was clear last night was that the Labour Party, through doing the same thing over and over again of moving to the right, moving to the right, moving to the right, moderating, had lost support, that had been looking for somewhere to go. And in some cases, I think last night there's evidence to suggest that some of those voters, particularly white working class voters, some of them had been attracted to the sort of alt-right equivalent, the nationalists of the UKIP party. Many of those came back to Labour yesterday.
UKIP. lost.
UKIP took a big beating. Labour managed to bring back some support in Scotland. The biggest thing, of course, was bringing on the youth, going from about a quarter of the under 25 vote to, I think the latest numbers say something like 75%, 72%. So I think the lessons for people here is a simple message, not crafted by focus groups, not wishy-washy, anxious about what the polling's going to say and what the tabloids are going to say, but that is from the heart, with history on its side, with a commitment to the many, not the few, really resonated. And I think that that has enormous lessons for us here.
When we reflect on what happened at our election, and then see the kind of fracturing in our country, there seem to be these sort of three, very broadly speaking, groupings: the Clinton backers, the Trump backers, and a bunch of people in the middle, many of whom are supporters of Bernie Sanders, but not all. And what we've seen with the Trump administration unfolding, unfortunately, is some of the Clinton backers digging their heels in and saying, you should have picked Clinton, we told you so. And all of the postmortems of Clinton's campaign still haven't zeroed in on the fact that she never really convinced Americans what the real reason was for her to run, except that it was her turn. So have we really made any progress in terms of understanding that the way to engage people, to strengthen our democracy and engage the majority of Americans, is to start saying things like people power over corporate power, et cetera? Or are we just back where we started?
Well, I think it was an interesting day yesterday because, I don't know about you, but my attention was really divided.
It's Thursday, by the way. We're talking on Friday.
Sorry, yes, Thursday. My attention was really divided between the Washington hearings with Comey's address to the Congress and what was happening in the UK. And it was almost like that's where we are. We could spend the rest of the next 3 years focusing on what happened in those early days of the Trump administration, and maybe there is impeachable material there. We could retain our focus, remain focused on Russian hacking and was the government involved actually, we don't know. Or we could be focusing on building our movement that goes beyond resistance, beyond impeachment, beyond Mike Pence, to actually taking power on a people power agenda and platform. And I think that's what yesterday will live in my memory. That on the one hand, we have this kind of Trump circus that threatens to engage and sort of hold our attention for all eternity, every minute of the news hour, or we have this possibility of learning from what's happened in the UK. I hope that we do both. We need to have a media that can tell more than one story at a time. We need to have a movement that can walk and chew gum. We need to be resisting and building. And we need media that goes beyond the headlines to talk about what is really going on at the root of things. Because we've not gotten to the bottom of what happened in the last election. There has been neither the reflection nor the reporting that that election deserved.
And so here we are at the People's Summit, where there are organizers of all stripes, some of them working in local campaigns, some of them even candidates themselves running for office, a lot of Bernie backers, some people calling on Bernie to be drafted into a new party. Are there too many focuses? What do you hope will play out at this gathering, the People's Summit, that really has brought together quite an interesting and stellar cast of activists known and not so known?
Well, you know, I came with one interest in particular. Obviously, I'm curious to see how this movement is developing after last year. But I'm particularly interested in whether we can marry our movements around economic democracy, the sort of work that we cover a lot on our show, with our movements for political democracy. Because we have a situation in the United States right now where not only economic power, but also political power, is concentrated in very few hands in the executive branch of government and a few decision makers in our movements and in our parties. Can we blend a movement for economic democracy, which is to say a voice in the workplace, an ownership piece of our community wealth, and a re-embrace of the commons? Can we create that spirit of fellow feeling and of commonwealth and of sharing the assets and finding some new ways to organize our society and our economy, and marry that with our new model of politics that maybe isn't the same as state socialism or industrial capitalism, but is something new. I mean, I think we're here for something new. So much as I love Jeremy Corbyn, he's not new enough, although his platform did include state support for cooperatives, which was a first. But that's what I'm really interested in. Can we marry those two things together? Because I think through the lens of the economic democracy movement, we can have some conversations about power and money and resources and decision making that cross that span across political divides. Right and left want to talk about these things. People want policies and change that affects the way they are living and the reality in their communities. And if we combine that with some understanding of we need some new sorts of people running for office on some new sorts of manifestos, and maybe we need to organize our governance systems differently, then I think we can really get somewhere and create a model. But step number one is we need to have a Corbyn moment. I think that we need to show that some real change can be made. And maybe that involves focusing in one or two places and making that change in a way that's visible to all and inspiring.
One of the things that I sort of see playing out in this era that we live in right now is that we have had a very deliberate and political scapegoating of minorities, in particular people of color, under the Trump administration to a very interesting effect. And unfortunately, what it's almost done is played into the hands of Democrats who've been able to say, yes, look, we were the party that people of color should have chosen, and we are the place that will talk about identity politics, quote unquote, because we don't want to talk about economics and economic justice. And so choose between the Republican Party that demonizes and targets people of color or the Democratic Party that pays lip service to people of color only on issues of very narrowly defined set of issues. And it leaves out a lot of us. So we're left in this weird dichotomy, and I'm wondering if our grassroots movements are addressing those a little bit better than the parties are. I hope they are.
Yeah, no, it's complicated. I mean, we're put in a position of having to defend principles that are embraced by people who never actually practice those principles. But when they become under attack, we suddenly have to go to their defense as progressive people. It's a trick. It's a kind of bait and switch situation. But you put your finger on it that we have been in this very frustrating situation for a very long time. And it has to do with who's telling the story of our lives right now. And I think we know who's telling the story, and not to be too craven about it, but who's telling the story are corporations invested in war, poison, extraction, competition, capitalism, consumerism. They benefit from all of those things. So the story of how those systems put us at odds with each other and the planet, and the need to create some new system, is not a story that's going to be told by that media. We need media that is invested in culture shift. I think the Free Speech TV and the work that you do, the work that I do, institutions like Pacifica that gave both of us a start, are the kind of media that we need to promote and cover that culture shift. And we just need the support to be able to do it. But we're here, we're still here, we're doing this work, and I think that our next challenge is to work with local media outlets to really listen to the conversations that are happening locally and see if we can intervene in ways that bring light as well as heat, put it that way, and can maybe make some new connections, because at the moment there's only one sort of story being told about how people got into the fix that they're in, and that story is it's the people of color that did it. It's the immigrants that did it. It's the women that did it. We need a different story.
Laura, where can people find out more about your work, your websites, show information? Just throw it all out there so people if they aren't already familiar with you, can find out.
So they can watch The Laura Flanders Show right here on Free Speech TV on a Friday, I think, and multiple times during the week. They can find out all about our program at lauraflanders.com. Follow the Instagram, the Twitter feed, you name it. I look forward to being on this journey further with you, Sonali. It's been a good one so far. We'll keep at it.
Same here. My sister in arms, Laura Flanders. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I've been speaking with Laura Flanders, a broadcast journalist, progressive activist, best-selling author. She is also a contributing writer to The Nation magazine and Yes magazine. The Laura Flanders Show airs on Free Speech TV. I spoke with Laura at the People's Summit in Chicago. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.